My name is Jordan, and like I said a second ago, I'm coming to you from Dallas, Texas. This is a picture of my family, really briefly. That's my wife, Emily, who is back in the back, and those are our children, our daughter, Georgia, on the left, and then our baby, our youngest, John, on the right, and then in the middle is Sam, our oldest, who I'll talk about more as we go along. I first became acquainted with Mockingbird in, oh, did that go away? Everything just went away. Wow. It's all gone. Well, we'll just keep going. I first became acquainted with Mockingbird, around the year 2012 or 2013. I was still a Presbyterian at the time, but I would kind of moonlight at Christ Episcopal, there in Charlottesville. That's when I first met, Dave Zoll, and became acquainted with Mockingbird, and I've been a fan ever since. And I know everyone, when they come and speak at Mockingbird, sort of gushes about Mockingbird and kind of tells their Mockingbird testimony and how they gave their life to Mockingbird. But I, or gave their life to Dave Zoll, or however the case may be. Let me see here. I think I'm, does technology ever work? It never works. This morning I tried to print something, and of course, the printer at the hotel didn't work. Printers never work. These things never work. I think we may. No signal? All right. Well, we'll just keep going. Okay, the one thing I want to say about Mockingbird is that, and this is an ironic thing to say about Mockingbird, but what I want to say about Mockingbird is that Mockingbird works. Mockingbird works. Which is to say, the message and the grace that you hear in Mockingbird actually changes people. And it changes people's lives. It changed my life, and I know it's changed many of yours. The way you relate to God and also how you relate to the people that you love. Okay, we'll back up now. So that's a picture of me in 2012 with Will McDavid, who some of you might know. And we went to a Tampa Bay Rays baseball game, and we thought it was funny that it said Redemption Center because Mockingbird, and that's us taking an ironic picture. And there you go. Okay, so our topic today is the speed of love, the church in the age of efficiency. And what I want to start by saying this morning is that we are actually, as a culture, not as divided as we might think. That while we may have our divisions over politics or visions of racial justice or gender, there is, again, one thing we can all agree on, and that is efficiency. It is living our lives as quickly and productively as possible. Everyone, right, left, race, country, everyone agrees on getting stuff done. We all want to do the things we have to do as quickly and productively as possible so that we can save time to do the things we want to do, even if, increasingly, we don't even know what those things we want to do even are. We're sort of like the people at the airport who want to get on the plane as quickly as possible just so we can sit in our seats and gawk at our phones, right? Why are we in such a hurry? Again, we are living in the age of efficiency. And far from being a problem just for people out there, efficiency culture has affected us inside the walls of the church. And again, the biggest problem with our obsession with efficiency and productivity is not just that it is making us miserable, which it is, but it is keeping us from love. And so I want us ultimately this morning to imagine together an inefficient church. A community of people willing to slow down so that we can love the actual people in our actual lives. That's our goal. So I don't have to tell you that our lives today are moving faster and faster than ever before. But it's not just that things are moving faster. It's that they're actually doing so at an accelerating rate. The German philosopher Hartmut Rosa calls this social acceleration. The idea that things are getting exponentially faster and faster, such that if life felt two times faster from 2000 to 2010. From 2010 to 2020, things felt 4 or 5 or 10 times faster. There has been, he calls, a shrinking of the present or of the now, such that increasingly nothing stays the same for long. And Rosa says the reasons for this social acceleration are both cultural and personal. Culturally, we live in a capitalistic world that says you must keep innovating and growing and producing and grinding just to keep up. The only way to achieve stability, whether as an individual or a company, is to move faster. Think of the irony of that. To move is to be stable, and to stay still is to fall behind. So acceleration means we must speed up just in order to keep up. But there are also personal reasons. Rosa says first, the logic of capitalism is inherently competitive. And so it's very difficult not to allow competitiveness to seep into every corner of our lives. But also, he says we like changing and we like moving quickly. It's connected to our ideas of freedom and happiness. To move quickly is exhilarating, and it makes us feel powerful and alive. And this brings us to another philosopher named Jacques Ellul, who said this. He said, the increasing demands that the modern world places upon us leave us feeling more and more vulnerable, such that we are therefore more and more tempted to rely upon what he called techniques. His phrase was la technique, which is French for the technique. And but it sounds better when it's la technique. And he said la technique is this. It is the totality of methods rationally arrived at and having absolute efficiency in every field of human activity. Here's what he means. Every field of human activity, whether that is learning to hit a golf ball, or dieting, or parenting, or having sex, can and must have a one best way. It's like Plato with his ideals. The ideal for anything for us is the one most efficient way to do that thing. And so all of life becomes then a quest to find the one best way. The one best way to parent, the one best way to eat, the one best way to exercise or to sex, and so on. Every human activity becomes what one person has called a seculosity, with rules and protocols and techniques for doing it right. But the problem with these techniques is they sell us a bad set of goods. We think these techniques and these protocols and these procedures will liberate us, but they actually enslave us further. How? Because first, any technique, whether it's a technology like a smartphone or a computer, or whether it's a protocol from, you know, Joe Rogan or Andrew Huberman for dieting or exercising, these techniques convince us we cannot live without them. They're like the ring in Lord of the Rings. You can't not have them. But then secondly, these techniques make us think that we need more and more of them, again, just to keep up or not fall behind. And so what we have then is this vicious cycle where we are all moving quickly and we're all more and more miserable. And so therefore, we are more vulnerable and susceptible to being obsessed with techniques. But these techniques then only make us move faster and faster and make us more and more miserable. And around we go. And this means that in the age of efficiency, time is our most precious commodity. Time. It feels as if our time has been stolen. It feels as if there's never enough to go around. And so like money, time is something to protect and something to hoard and something to spend wisely and only on things that are worth it. But this goes for people too. Because increasingly, it's not just that fewer and fewer things feel worth our time, but also people. To be a person is to be productive. And so it's questionable whether non-productive people are actually persons at all. And this is a theme of the show Succession. There's our guy, Kendall. You'll remember the refrain throughout Succession about real people, and they're constantly saying, this person's not a real person. You're not a real person. And in fact, you'll remember there was this cruise ship and these murders that took place on this cruise ship early on in Waystar, you know, early on in the company, and they sort of buried the whole story for years and years and years because they said there were no real persons involved, right? I mean, these were just, you know, natives from islands or something that were doing these kind of menial jobs on the cruise ship. And because they died, no real persons were involved in the accident. And this is us. Because again, when it feels like we never have enough time, we only want to invest our time in people who will give us a good return on our investment. And so what do? We start magnet schools for children we identify as talented and gifted, or our best and brightest. We hire those who bring something to the table. And increasingly, in the name of self-care or boundaries, we cut out people who are toxic or difficult. And doesn't it seem like year after year, the goalposts are changing on what qualifies as a toxic person? Seems like everyone is toxic at this point. Certainly I am. And all this began to hit me for the first time a few years ago, again with the birth of my oldest son, Sam. Because my son, Sam, is not an efficient person. Sam was born, quote, healthy, as far as we knew. And for the first 20 months of his life, everything seemed, quote, normal. But then he began showing delays in language and in gross motor skills. When Sam was 2.5, we discovered that he had epilepsy and that he had been having silent seizures ever since he was born. We didn't know. And then when he was 3, he was diagnosed as autistic. And I have to say that before Sam was born, I hardly knew what autism was. Okay, the phrase neurodivergent meant nothing to me. I'd had very little exposure to or interest in persons with disabilities. But Sam, parenting him and being his father, has been a revelation for me. He has revealed God to me in profound ways. And the best way to say it is that Sam's life has revealed to me just how many things I'm enslaved by. First, I realize how enslaved I am by time, because my son moves slowly. He walks slowly. He talks slowly. And so I've had to learn that in order to love Sam, I must move at his speed. Here are a couple pictures. There's me and Sam. He's giving me what he calls a cheek kiss, where he puts his cheek up to mine. That's how he kisses. There he is lining up golf balls, as many autistic children will line up toys, as you might know. And I want to show this video of him playing golf. Sam loves to play golf, probably because I do, and also because I think the ball like provides this immediate sensory feedback for him, you know? And when I take Sam to the driving range, this thing happens where sometimes he will stand over the ball and just hit it immediately and quote, normally. But then other times, he will stand over the ball for 25 or 30 seconds before actually hitting it. And here's a video where it takes him 24 seconds to hit the ball. Yeah. There you go. 24 seconds. And at first, I mean, I was incredibly frustrated by some of his slowness. Because, again, it was abnormal, and it wasn't what I expected of my life with my first son. The second thing we're not going to get to that one yet. The second thing I realized how enslaved I was is by what I want to call the tyranny of the normal. Because as theologian John Swinton, who has been incredibly influential for me in all this talk around time and disability, as Swinton says, our notions of what is normal are very intimately tied to our notions of speed and of time. And so a child is normal if they show appropriate language at the right moments or milestones in time. And an adolescent is normal if they graduate from high school at the normal age of 18. Or a human body is, again, normal if it walks or talks at a normal rate of speed. And I want to show this video. Maybe some of you saw this a few years ago in the New York Times about this man who stutters. And this begins to get at some of the ways in which our world is moving too quickly and is not often able to slow down to love the people in our life. Hopefully y'all can hear this okay.
Struggles to say them out loud. While most people who stutter as children grow out of it, John is part of the 20% who continue stuttering into adulthood. And there's no real cure. For John, no amount of therapy, exercises, or hypnosis has done the trick. So we're going to run an experiment. Imagine a special machine called a listenometer that works like this. John talks into this end, and his words go into this box, which removes the stuttering from his speech. There are actually three different types of stutters. They're called repetitions, prolongations, and blocks. That's why the listenometer has these three levers. Push the lever down, and the machine will begin removing that type of stutter. Just listen to what it sounds like when we push all of them down.
It's perpetually frustrating to know exactly what you want to say and not be able to say it. I ask myself, is anyone ever going to give me a job? Am I ever going to be able to find a partner, get married, and set my vows? Everyone expects you to have beat it by now, because adults know how to talk.
The listenometer makes John's speech as smooth and buttery as his written words. It injects fluency, which society demands. Turn on the radio and we expect a soundbite. Pick up the telephone and we expect an immediate response when we say hello. For the longest time, stuttering has been described as an issue with speech. But what if instead we turn the focus on you, the listener? As John talks, I'll be adjusting the listenometer, leaving in more and more of these stuttering speech patterns. Your job is to keep listening as the stuttering intensifies. Ready? First, I'm going to leave in John's repetitions.
That first moment in which a person begins to stutter and takes everyone around them by surprise, it's a painful
When we leave in John's repetitions, we hear him stutter briefly at the beginning of...
I'm going to pause, but that begins to give you an idea of John. I would encourage y'all to Google that, and it's pretty profound, at least for me. But it strikes me that, again, what we do oftentimes is we are like the listenometer, right? Where we want to remove the things and people from our life that make us uncomfortable so that they can, again, move at the speed at which we would like them to move. And I say to my shame that I notice, again, this tyranny in myself. My son, he doesn't stutter necessarily, but he does something called stimming, which any of you kind of familiar with autism will know that this is often a thing which you do. You experience something exciting or stimulating in the world, and so your body literally shakes. And so for my son, I mean, every stim kind of looks different, but for my son, you know, he flaps his hands, and he his face will kind of tighten up, and then he also often will kind of do like this. And we live in Dallas in a very, normal and typical place. And we have a lot of beautiful parks, and I will take him to these parks often. And I confess that I'm just, my stomach is in knots. The whole time we're at these parks, I'm just like, please don't stim. Like, please don't do it. Don't do the thing, right? And I'll even tell him at times, I'm like, all right, Sam, do we stim at the park? And he'll be like, no stimming at the park. And again, this is all for me. It's an attempt at controlling him so that I can feel better about my life. The third thing I began to see with my son is how much I and our world is enslaved to words, or what some have called hypercognition. Because in the age of efficiency, everything must be measured. Right? Everything must be tracked and measured. And I began to realize that for me, and I think for many of us as Christians, words become the primary measurement we use to judge our relationship with God. We imagine the tether or connection between us and God to be primarily a matter of words, of quickly reading and absorbing and articulating the right words about God. And in such a world, it is only those who have words and who think and speak quickly and clearly who get to be close to God. Like the Pharisees, we think we will be heard because of our many words. We see this in church in the most egregious cases, where this kind of, you know, I like to call it wordism or explainism comes in, when only those who can offer coherent verbal testimonies can be baptized or perhaps come to the table. But more generally, it seems to me in our churches, we simply imagine it to be the case that people without words, or at least spoken words, are less spiritually mature or close to God. And what I begin to realize over time is that all of these things I've mentioned, these different things I'm enslaved by, whether it's the tyranny of speed and time, or it's the tyranny of the normal, or it's the tyranny of words, they're really all about the same thing. And they're about control. They're about control. Because really, it is control that lies behind the curtain. Control is our idol behind the idol. It's the idol behind our efficiency and our productivity and our speed and our acceleration. We just want control. We want to control God. We want to control our lives. And we want to control the people in our lives. And so what I want to do now in our remaining time is trace three movements out of efficiency culture. I want us to look at our view of time, our view of God, and our view of church. So first of all, first movement is time, from time as money to time as gift. Three aspects about time. First, time is created. Second, it's redeemed. And then finally, it is given. Time is created. This was important for St. Augustine, who said that time is a creature. The time is something that was created by God. The time was created even as birds and fish and squirrels were created. And dwelling upon this notion that time was created by God protects us from thinking that we are the ones who make or break time. That we are the ones who create time or free time up or else squander or waste time. God made time. Time belongs to God. And so the next question is, why did God make time? And the answer is that he made time for the same reason he made anything. The same reason he made birds or fish or squirrels. I mean, he made time because he wanted to. He made time because he thought it would be fun. He created time in order to love, in order to have a relationship with us and communicate his love through creation. So as John Swinton says, time is best conceived as an aspect of God's love for the world. Time is a creature born out of God's love, intended as an arena for the revelation of that world. And this means then that the purpose of time is to facilitate and sustain love. Second, time has been redeemed, which is to say, in the life, death, and resurrection of Christ, God has already done and is doing everything that needs to be done in time. If time, as Swinton says, is the arena of love, the arena where God's love is played out, as it were, then Christ has taken the field and the Holy Spirit continues to play on the field such that, again, all that needs to happen in time has already happened or is happening. And what this means for us is that far from not having enough time, far from it being the case that we have no time to lose, we actually have all the time in the world. It is as if we're at a casino and we have already won big. And so now we're simply playing with house money or house time. Second thing to say is that time has been given. And one of the reasons that we do not feel as if time is a gift, but instead we feel as if it is a burden, and one of the reasons our relationship with time is so warped and so highly controlled, is because we have been insulated from death and a sense of our own mortality. The theologian Ephraim Radner calls it the great transition. This is amazing. The great transition, the rapid increase in life expectancy. In the year 1800, the average human died at the age of 33. In the year 1900, hold on, let's just think about this. All these names of these old white dudes on these walls, they all, you know, the wardens and the vestrymen, they all probably, very few of them lived beyond the age of 45 or 50, right? By the year 1900, average life expectancy had gone to 47 years, and again, by the year 2000, it jumped to 80 years. Again, there's some acceleration, there's that rapid increase. And what this means is that we are actually the first humans to have the luxury of thinking about time as money, as something that we can save or spend. But as Radner says, we need to stop asking, even as Christians, how we should spend our time, and instead ask how to offer it. Because the first question, how to spend our time, still assumes that time is ours. It's like Jake said last night, mine. That time is something we have accumulated, and the time is something we can then spend as we see fit. But the second question, how to offer time, assumes that time is a gift. That time belongs to God, and that God, for whatever reason, has given us time, even if it's a short amount of time, to then offer to the world. So the question is how to offer that which has already been offered to us. And so the transition, or movement in thinking about time is this. Again, not how to spend, but how to offer. And this requires some new math in our brains, sort of a recalculation for how we think about time. Because as another has said, when time is money, speed equals more of it. But when time is love, speed equals less of it. And I think that's true. Second movement is our view of God. And I want us to imagine a God who isn't resourceful, but is wasteful. Because in the 5 years of my son's life, a question that has been coming up for me and I'm pondering more and more is God efficient? Is he efficient? Because in the age of efficiency, the answer is obvious. Of course God's efficient, right? I mean, God is something like, he's something like actually the God, you know, in the parable last night. He's the manager of, you know, perhaps an industrial factory. And he stands at the big window of his office overlooking the factory floor and making sure everyone in the assembly line is doing their job in order to ensure maximum output. He is a God, we think, obsessed with stewardship, which is often a thinly veiled Christian way to talk about efficiency. Take efficiency, sprinkle some holy water on it, stewardship. And so God's job is to make sure we steward the jobs, resources, gifts, and opportunities he's given us. He's a God, again, obsessed with ROI, his return on investment, because to whom much has been given, much is required. And yet, is this the God we read about in the Gospels? I always think about here about Jesus attending the dinner at the house of Simon the Pharisee, and this woman who has wasted her life as a prostitute comes and breaks an alabaster jar and pours out the expensive perfume on Jesus' feet. And in this profound and beautiful act, all the Pharisees can think about is the jar. And what do they say? They say, why this waste? This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor, which sounds a lot like us. See, what the Pharisees don't understand is that both the woman and Jesus are a complete waste. They are entirely wasteful. She wastes the expensive jar on him. And this is a profound act because it directly reflects the love and mercy that he wastes on her and on us. And so God is not efficient. There is nothing efficient about giving your inheritance to your bratty son who runs away off to West Village and squanders it, and then upon his return, throwing a party for him. There's nothing efficient about leaving the 99 to find the one. God is bad at math. He's terrible at math. He's a terrible money manager. He's a waste. One of my favorite authors named, this is a name if you're into, Erasmo Leiva Mirakakis. That's an option if you're having, people do name their kids things like this today, right? Like Skylar and, you know, Flora or whatever. I just, like, offended so many people. Some of your kids are named that. So Erasmo's an option. Anyway, he calls it the necessary wastefulness of love. What he means here is it's not just that love is sometimes wasteful, but that love is necessarily so. That without waste, there can be no love. Love is always a waste. It makes me think of an excerpt I read recently from a book that was talking about whales, called Touching This Leviathan. And the author of the book about whales, his name is Peter Moe, and he's referring to another author named Kathleen Jamie, who also writes about whales. And really briefly, I was looking for like a clever, funny picture about whales, and I was going to do the like Free Willy Michael Jackson picture, but then it was too creepy. And so, but I found this. This is just for fun. This is a freebie. Look at Jesse from Free Willy, all grown up now. So anyway, that's just for fun. but whales. Here's what Peter Moe writes. In one of her essays, Kathleen Jamie visits the University of Bergen's Natural History Museum, which houses a miscellany of whale skulls and bones, as well as 24 complete skeletons dating to the 19th century. Suspended from the ceiling by chains and metal bars, the skeletons still drip oil. Poor whales, Jamie laments. Don't they know when to stop? The same whale oil that once greased the machines and lit the streets and parlors of the 19th century, that made the oil of soap and margarine, all that oil, here they were, dead for a century, still giving out oil. Which sounds a lot like God. Poor God. He doesn't know when to stop. Here he is, hundreds of years later, still pouring out his mercy. And so in order to be like God, we should be doing a lot more things that seem to the world as if they are a complete waste of time. What is the Sabbath if not a complete waste of time? What is playing or laughter if not a complete waste of time? What is spending time with inefficient people like my son or people who are messy and or inefficient in your life if not a complete waste of time? And this brings us to the third movement, which is church. I want to talk about the church and seeing the church not as productive, but as prodigal. Because in the age of efficiency, the church becomes a business. It becomes yet another vehicle for maximizing profit and getting a good return on our investment. The only difference being that the profit margins and the ROI are spiritual. And this is obvious, of course, in certain megachurches that we like to pick on, or in the fact that church growth theory is something that exists. But efficiency culture goes to church in less obvious ways as well. In order to spot efficiency culture in our churches, always look again for what is highly controlled, because that's the idol behind the idol. In the efficient church, there will probably be lots of systems in place, especially a small group system. There is often an outlined map or track for spiritual progress in which parishioners progress from one stage to the next. And this is, again, because in the age of efficiency, everything must be measured. And so you need ways to chart or to track people's spiritual maturity. Some of these markers are as follows. One, affiliation. Is this or that person affiliating with my programs? Are they joining my small group system? A second one is emotion. Is this or that person feeling the right feels about God? Are they, quote, on fire? And a third, again, is cognition. Is this or that person thinking the right things about God and then showing me that they think the right things about God by articulating the right words about God? And in the efficient church, it is not evident what place there is for people who aren't efficient or who don't track. It's not evident what we do with people who are slow, perhaps people with dementia who aren't themselves anymore, people who don't possess the words, again, that we would like to hear or the self-awareness that we expect. In the efficient church, perhaps such people will be tolerated or maybe even included, but it's not evident whether such people will ever really belong. In the efficient church, perhaps we will serve these people, but it's not evident whether we expect them to serve us. So I want to close with five adjectives to describe what an inefficient church might look like, okay? And then we'll be done. The inefficient church. First, the inefficient church is slow. It is moving at what some theologians have called the speed of love. Because God is slow. Or at least this is what the Japanese theologian Kazuki Koyama says in his book, 3 Mile an Hour God. The point is this. Humans walk at an average speed of 3 miles per hour. And that means that God, in the person of Christ, walked on average at a speed of 3 miles per hour. And this means that if we are walking faster than 3 miles per hour, it is likely that we are getting out in front of God. And we are not following him, but something or someone else we've made him. And so in the inefficient church, we are learning to move at the speed of love. We are learning to slow down, and not just for therapeutic reasons and to be happier, although we will be, but again, so that we can love the actual people in our actual lives. We are learning that what the Supreme is saying is true. You can't hurry love. You just have to wait. Second, the inefficient church is expectant. It is expectant. What I mean here is that we expect God to be present in any person who walks in our doors. No matter how difficult or draining or disabled they might be. It makes me think of the two passages that stand side by side, juxtaposed against one another in the Gospels, where first comes the rich young ruler, surely an efficient person, right? And you can imagine the disciples, the rich young ruler shows up, you can imagine kind of get the kind of thought bubble in their brains, here's a man who could jumpstart our movement. Maybe he could give us some money, he could help us get where we want to go. And then the children come, these people who are not by nature efficient or productive. And Jesus says his kingdom belongs to them. And this means God's kingdom doesn't just include the inefficient, but it belongs to them. It means, in fact, that mired as we are in the age of efficiency, inefficient persons might just be one of the last signposts of God that we have left. So when the inefficient come into our lives, we watch for God. Third, the inefficient church is sacramental. And this one might be a little surprising or controversial. But what I mean is this. It means that we must believe that when we distribute the mysteries of God, whether it is his word proclaimed, or the waters of baptism, or the body and blood of communion, we believe that something happens. As a father of an autistic son, I can tell you that I take incredible comfort in knowing that my son has been plunged in the waters of baptism, that he eats from the Lord's table every Sunday, and that he hears the gospel read each week. And the efficacy or effectiveness of these moments is not tied to his ability to wrap his head around them or tell me what he thinks of them. The point is that the sacraments, to quote John Swinton again, do their own traveling. The scriptures, baptism, the Eucharist, they don't need us to drive them from point A to point B, but they do their own traveling. Think of the words of the Apostle Paul. Faith comes from hearing. He did not say faith comes from perfectly understanding or believing, but merely hearing. When Jesus first called the disciples on the lake and the disciple at the tax booth, did these men have any intellectual idea who he was? No. But they had faith. They trusted him, and that was enough. Here's the point. As Godfather of Mockingbird, Bobby F. Capon says, this is my favorite line of all the Capon lines. If the gospel is true at all, it is true already. If it is true at all, it is true already. No one can make the gospel, whether preached or the waters of baptism, or up here at the table, no one can make the gospel any more true than it already is, any more than we can make winter turn into spring. Friends, in Christ, it is already spring, and all we have to do is walk outside. Fourth, the inefficient church is playful. It is playful. Because increasingly I believe that if we ever want to learn how to love, we have to learn how to play. Play prepares us for love. How? Because in the age of efficiency, everything must be instrumentalized or calculated or a means to some greater end. But play, or purely enjoying something, is the only thing in the world that is an end in and of itself. It has no greater purpose. It is inherently unproductive. The ancients like to call such activities leisure or contemplation. It is going to an art museum and looking at the piece of art. That art can do nothing for you. You just look at it and enjoy it. And in the end, playing and loving are actually the same, because both playing and loving expect nothing in return. Joseph Pieper defined love as saying to another person, "It is good that you are here. I'm glad that you exist." Sounds like Peter on the mountain. It is good for us to be here. It is good that we are here. I'm glad you exist. And playing is saying the same thing. It is good that this game, or this moment, or this food, or this drink exists. I'm glad that we are here. And so playing and learning to enjoy things merely for what they are teaches us to love and to enjoy people merely for what they are. Here's the fifth and final one. The inefficient church is wasteful. Friends, again, we are a prodigal people. We are to squander our money, our time, our energy, and our hospitality, fully expecting that we will never get back what we put in. Like in the parable of the great banquet, we, the church, will send out invitations to our parties, and all the people we want to come won't, and all the people we don't want to come will. Amen. Like in the parable of the prodigal son, we will give all of our time and our energy to the people we love, and they will leave. Like in the feeding of the 4,000 and the 5,000, we will spend time creating elaborate banquets and spreading our tables, and we will always order too much food, and there will always be food left over. If we want to be like God, our ROI will always be bad. It will always be a waste. But we keep going. We keep hosting parties knowing no one will come. We keep preaching the gospel knowing it will fall on deaf ears. We keep setting the Lord's table knowing people will eat, leave, and not come back again until Easter. The world will look at us and say, "You could be doing better things with your time." And we will say, "You're right." The world will look at us and say, "What a waste." And we will say, "Thank you." In the end, inefficiency must be our glory, because inefficient is our crucified God. Amen. I want to close with a video of my son delighting. In the wonder of the world, of a contingent world that didn't have to exist but does, because God thought it would be fun. And my son, who in this video, I think is saying to the world, "Is it good for us to be here? And I'm glad that you exist." This is him. You'll get an idea of his stimming again here. And this is him stimming at a fountain at a park. And me doing everything I can to refrain from trying to control him, but just letting him have this moment.
Hey,
Amen. Thank you all.